Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support also comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. That, of course, is some of the most familiar and beloved film music ever composed. It is the main theme to Star Wars, music by John Williams. And anybody who was alive back in 1977 probably still remembers what it was like to sit in a darkened movie theater and have that magnificent music, never heard before, wash over us as the scenes of the first Star Wars film played out before our wondering eyes. And all these years later, the music of Star Wars still has a powerful hold over at least a lot of us. And apparently it has a powerful hold over my first morning show guest today, and that is Dr. Alvaro Garcia from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, who is the conductor of their orchestra. And in their concert that is coming up tomorrow night at 7 p.m., it will be a veritable feast for Star Wars fans with all kinds of music from the Star Wars movies. But I hasten to add that I think in no way does one have to be a Star Wars fan to enjoy tomorrow night's concert, because this is just magnificent music any way you slice it. And so this is an opportunity to hear some of these really familiar themes and some other themes that are not nearly so well known, actually, and in a couple of different formats, things are going to be presented. So it promises to be a really wonderful concert, again, tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at UW Parkside's Main Stage Theater. So not in Francis Bedford Hall, but rather in the main stage. I think that used to be called the ComArts Theater, right?
Yes, correct.
So once upon a time, but out on the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And Dr. Alvaro Garcia, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg, and thank you for having me here
today. Great. So you have done this before, that is, presented orchestra concerts at Parkside that feature front and center music from the Star Wars films. I'm curious how much this has to do with your own love of these films. I mean, do you come to all of this as a diehard Star Wars fan?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if I could label myself as a diehard fan, but certainly I am a fan of the movies. You know, back when I saw the first movies, not when they came out, probably I was still in the cradle at the time, but was around the 80s when all my friends, we were small children in schools, and, you know, it's a when the third movie of the original trilogy, The Return of the Jedi, came out, is when we really got a hold ourselves about, oh my God, look at all these figurines of the Star Wars, and then somehow all my friends and I became fans of it. But you know, the movies came and go. To have a VCR at home was a great commodity, at least in Spain when we were. So it's not like we could play like nowadays. You just pop the DVD in and you play it every time you want. So it was coming and going with the movies as they came and saw. But it was, you know, we were there.
You're right. And I wanted to make sure that I understood. I suspected that you lived in Spain at the time. So you actually... So these Star Wars films, of course, were popular the world over, including Spain. And so you were seeing this, I assume, with Spanish subtitles or Spanish dubbing?
No,
or do you recall?
Actually, it's funny because in Spain, they don't do much of subtitles at all. So it's all dubbing. So I never got to hear the original voices until I was in this country. Well, let alone I couldn't understand anything that they would have said that time because my English was non-existent then. But, you know, now, I mean, that you can see in the original format is much more exciting too.
So you didn't hear, for instance, James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader, you heard
Spanish actor with a deep voice imitating.
Trying to do his best. Yes. Oh, that would be really interesting. I would love to see a little of these Star Wars movies with other actors, and of course it would be other words as well, of course, in a completely different language.
Yes.
Well, how intriguing. Do you remember at the time when you first saw, for instance, Return of the Jedi, do you remember the music having a lot of impact and you appreciating the music of John Williams, or did that come much later for you?
Well, I mean, at the time, of course, my experience in the world of music was very little. I mean, I started when I was 8 years old with music, so, and probably around the same time as when we started looking at the first movies of Star Wars back in Spain. It's basically, you could recognize the music, but it's not like nowadays I analyze the music in my head, right? It's not the same thing. But I will say I was more deeply involved, musically speaking, much later in life when my, you know, musical skills were far more advanced. And then you can look at the music and analyze the themes and the motifs that John Williams uses for each character and how that represents into each character. You know, once you learn about what an opera is, you know, in essence, then you start to see all the relationships between of how the music is composed and A is the action in the movie. You know, Star Wars are kind of an incredible feat at the time in terms of musically for the movies that were composed. I mean, we were getting out of Hollywood an era in which there was very little music in the movies. Mm. And all of a sudden, John Williams is being asked to compose basically an opera within a movie. So in this case, you know, to see the thematic recurrence and the compositional aspects of it, it was very interesting to be able to analyze that once I had those skills. Also.
Right. Well, and I hadn't really stopped to think about it, but I think you're absolutely right that one way in which you could think of these film scores as almost opera scores for a typical opera is wall-to-wall music. I mean, once in a while you have an opera where there is spoken dialogue, but mostly it's everything is sung, so everything is music. And likewise in these Star Wars films, although nobody is ever singing, but there is almost always music in the background. And, of course, it's more typical, and I suppose especially in that period, something else I hadn't thought about, more typical for there to be long stretches in a film where people are just speaking on stage and there is no music in the background at all.
Correct.
And in these Star Wars films, there's almost always music going on.
There's very specific moments in which you actually see or actually you hear silence.
Yeah.
There is always something going on behind the score, and so it's a developing of a motif or an idea coming back, but the music, it really almost never stops. So in a sense, you look at it almost like, okay, there's no one singing, but it's the same length of we are getting to an opera
Yeah.
type of construction.
Interesting. Yes. We're speaking with Dr. Alvaro Garcia, who is the orchestra conductor at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And their concert tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on the main stage theater is devoted start to finish to some of the magnificent music that is from the Star Wars films. And, of course, there's a whole lot of films by now. And I suspect that you are sampling many of them.
Yes.
Not just the first, you know, several films that for a long time were the only Star Wars films
correct.
Out there.
So there is three areas that we focus on in the concert. Is the first, of course, trilogy. We have some music that comes from that, the one of the main themes that we have there. But also we are going to hear some of the themes that normally you don't hear, like the parade of the Ewoks or the Forest Battle, for example. So we bring parts of two different suites that they were done from the movies. The original trilogy movies. And then we also look at the Force Awakens music, which is kind of the music that it recurrence comes back and forth from the what they call now the sequel trilogy or the latest movies that they come up. Even we were able to include a little bit of The Last Jedi too in terms of musical movies. And finally, the other part that we included was also music from the Star Alone, the movie that stays by itself, which is Rogue One. And that's the movie that connects basically the second trilogy they came out, which is what they call the prequel trilogy, to the original trilogy. And that's that is score, although the music is by Michael Giacchino, it really brings the depth because, of course, Michael Giacchino is somewhat influenced by the music of John Williams, so there is still some connection there with Star Wars. But the music for that film is actually a much bigger depth of in terms of character and sentiment. Because Michael Giacchino concentrated not in the individual characters to give them a motif or a melodic element, if not, he just took an idea which recurs through the entire movie, which is the idea of hope. And that idea of hope is really deeply involved into the music. There is kind of a remembrance of the fallen heroes of the rebellion. So that has a much deeper meaning that, for example, the music that you see on the original trilogy.
Right. Was last year when you... No, you've done this more than once.
Yes, this actually is the third concert that we have because with this latest trilogy that is coming out, we every time the movie came out, we made a Star Wars concert.
Okay. How was this received the first time around? I don't mean by the public, because I know it went over like gangbusters. I'm thinking about your young musicians. When they first heard that there was going to be a concert in which they'd be playing music like this, you know, not Beethoven or Haydn or Mozart or the kind of things they were probably used to playing underneath you.
Yeah, all the decisions that I make programmatic are based on pedagogy. We are a teaching institution, so we always try to fulfill that mission. But one of the missions that we have is that within pedagogy in the orchestra, and there's a lot of, you know, college orchestras are doing this, we are bringing now pops concerts into the mixture because we realize that many of the musicians and us as professionals, we get out of the school, you know, your Brahms, Beethoven, Schumann, Schubert, you know, and then you go out and then you start playing pops music and then you get caught.
Right.
Because this is not the type of music that you are regular. Typically, the rhythms, the harmonies are completely different from
right.
what you are used to.
And in many cases, it's not easy to play.
It's actually much harder.
Right. It's easy to listen to, but that doesn't mean that it's simple music that doesn't pose a lot of very significant challenges. I suppose in some ways, this is really cool because that is the music you're going to be playing tomorrow night because in some ways it's both. It's the kind of music that would appear on a lighter pops kind of concert, and yet at least a lot of it is written very symphonically. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it follows all the tradition of the symphonic music, but it's the type of music that the kids are extremely excited to play. And then when the first time open the book and look at the music, they say, oh,
right,
I do really need to practice this music.
Yeah. Right.
This is not easy to play.
Not easy. Well, you've brought with you some examples of at least some of the music that is going to be played tomorrow night. And I thought it would be fun for us to sample at least a couple of them. So why don't you pick out one of the tracks that you think would be especially interesting for people to hear because it might be something a little less commonly heard?
Yeah, so the next track that we are going to hear, it comes from Rogue One, is a sample of that is called the movement Jyn Erso and Hope. And it focuses basically in the deep meaning of hope. It is all in a minor quality because Rogue One has a big, big tragic ending. But then there is a glimpse of hope in which the movement turns to a major quality in a G major chord that we are going to see in the end,
cool,
towards the end. So it's really, really deeply felt by all the musicians and the people that normally hears it. So.
And again, unlike everything else on tomorrow night's concert, this music is actually by composer Michael Giacchino.
Correct.
And again, this is from the Star Wars film called Rogue One.
Thank you.
That is absolutely marvelous music by Michael Giacchino from the film Rogue One, part of the Star Wars legacy. And that wonderful piece is going to be one of the pieces played tomorrow night by the UW Parkside Orchestra in the Main Stage Theater. Tomorrow night, 7 p.m., a concert devoted entirely to the marvelous music from Star Wars. That is so beautifully crafted, and you were saying that's one of the reasons we played it start to finish is the beautiful haunting quality, and most of it in G minor, and then that wonderful radiant shift to G major at the very, very end. Beautiful, beautiful music.
Signs of hope.
Yeah, absolutely. We all need that, don't we? So you had the music of, well, I guess something like 10 films to choose from to put tomorrow night's concert together. What did you think about in terms of making the choices of what to include, how to put this concert together?
You know, I mean, it has been some sort of a collective process of three different concerts. What we had done before, what we should do as new, because, you know, I don't like to repeat things. So, of course, some things you had to bring back to connect the dots. But some other things are new, like Rogue One, the Star Wars saga, which is, you know, the least heard music, and probably we are going to hear a little bit after this about that one. But, you know, the collective process is normally, you know, this is what you want to do. Secondly, you go about what's available to you, and thirdly, what your funding allows you to get. Because, as you can imagine, funding for these and copyrights are truly expensive. So it's a collective process of several years of buying the music, of collecting the music, and to be able to do a full concert of Star Wars. That's what it takes, because we do use the professional series, which is the hardest music and the most expensive too. So
these are not just shallow little arrangements.
I mean, normally what comes out of the market normally first is quick, small arrangements, reduced for high schools and so for the kids to play. But no, these are the professional pop series of John Williams and Michael Giacchino that they are put out there.
Right, for real orchestras to play.
For the professional orchestras.
Right. Explain how things are going to be presented tomorrow night in terms of sort of the visuals of tomorrow night's concert.
So for the visuals of tomorrow night, what we are not doing is actually presenting any kind of movie or theatrical movie that's under the copyright, so that will be almost costly prohibited for us. But what we are trying to do is just to offer the music, and then we are going to use the main stage to provide some light design done by the students of the theater department under the direction of Jake Prey, our light design professor. And then we are going to have our student actors have been doing some Foley sounds to complement transitions between the music and some acting in the transitions about the music, creating our own narrative of a story to connect the different movements, since we are going from different movies back and forth, kind of creating our own story behind the whole thing. And that was our students in the theater department under the direction of our digital sound instructor, Professor Kevin Gray.
Great. That's a really nice idea.
So he has put all together between all the musicians in my orchestra and everyone involved in this production, we are about 100 people.
Wow. Wonderful. Well, let's, to finish out, sample one more thing that's going to be played tomorrow night. And you were saying this is also something that's a little more out of the ordinary, not so commonly heard if one goes and hears, a 20-minute suite of most famous Star Wars themes. This is not going to be one of them, but that doesn't mean this isn't wonderful music.
Yes, and this is actually the Forest Battle at the end of the Return of the Jedi. We have the forest battle with the Ewoks and the rebels trying to basically blow up a shield array that protects the Death Star. And this is the music that actually in the movie starts right when Chewbacca is swinging out of a core basically in the moment that the battle turns in their favor.
Mm.
And the qualities of this music is very much, you know, like a Stravinsky almost type of quality beginning. It's very disruptive. You are in the middle of the battle, but nevertheless, it's just wonderful music.
Great. So this is going to be the Forest Battle music, which is from Return of the Jedi. And we want to remind you again that this is just one of the pieces that will be played tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at UW Parkside's Main Stage Theater. The orchestra there playing a whole night of music from Star Wars. And on the podium conducting it all, Dr. Alvaro Garcia. Great to have you here, and I'm excited to share the news about this exciting concert tomorrow
night.
Thank
you. And just to remind people, tickets are going fast, so get your tickets online.
Ah, very good. Concert. So go to uwp.edu
/Rita.
And there you go. Very good. Here is Forest Battle.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. And again, that was music from The Return of the Jedi, one of the Star Wars films. And tomorrow night's concert by the orchestra at the University of Wisconsin Parkside will feature wall-to-wall music from the Star Wars films, most of it by the great John Williams and Dr. Alvaro Garcia conducting. And you want to go to uwp.edu/RITA, R-I-T-A, to find out more information about the concert and how to secure your tickets. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And to finish out today's morning show, we're going to be talking about something else exciting happening at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside this weekend, namely the opening of a play which is called Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson. And this is a play that is most appropriate in this year when we are celebrating the upcoming centennial of women's suffrage in the United States. And that important milestone is touching off a lot of special events and presentations here and everywhere. And Silent Sky folds very nicely into that, and we'll let our guests explain all the reasons why. First of all, I'm happy to have with me Jennifer Sassaman from the faculty of the University of Wisconsin Parkside Theater Department, who is the director of this production, and two of the actors who are part of this production as well, Bailey Johnston and Josh Pride. And we welcome all of you to the morning show.
Hello, good morning. It's good to be back.
Good to have you here. So, Jennifer Sassaman, maybe you can explain the enigmatic words that I just said about how appropriate this play is in this school year in which a lot of places like Parkside and Carthage and other schools are celebrating the history of women. Explain how this play, Silent Sky, very nicely folds into that.
Well, the play Silent Sky is about three women from history, from the turn of the last century, and the idea of women's suffrage is actually a part of the text, although it's not the primary focus. It's really about three scientists who dramatically changed the field that they were a part of. In particular, it focuses on Henrietta Leavitt Swan, but it also features Wilhelmina Fleming and Annie Jump Cannon, and they were all astronomers who worked at the Harvard Observatory around the turn of the last century. And Annie Jump Cannon wound up being quite heavily involved in the suffrage movement and really pushed hard for the passage of the 19th Amendment.
Wow.
So, but we do focus on Miss Swan in this play. She's the center of the story.
Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and that is the character that is portrayed by Bailey Johnston. So Jennifer Sassaman, tell me a little bit about how you first became acquainted with this play and what specifically prompted you to want to do it at Parkside.
Well, I first became aware of this play. I do some work with a couple of theaters back east in the summers, and one of the companies that I work with had just done a production of Silent Sky. So while I was in a musical there, I kept seeing the poster, and it's this gorgeous night sky, and I was asking everybody, what's this play? I've never heard of this play, because it's a fairly new story that's out there, although Lauren Gunderson is a very popularly produced playwright at this point. A lot of theater people avoid the sciences and maths as if they are terrifying, but I loved math and I loved science. So to learn that there is a play that celebrates women scientists, I was definitely fascinated by the prospect of working on a show like this. It's also a small cast. The last several shows that I've done at Parkside have had close to 20 people in them. And that's a really great energy to have on stage. But when you have five actors, you can really focus on building an ensemble and really dive into the text and create sort of a sense of warmth and intimacy that is harder to do when you have a massive show that you've only got 4 weeks to get on its feet.
So tell us how Lauren Gunderson tells this story. I mean, is it a fairly straightforward telling of these historical events with these historic figures, or does she play with history a little bit?
I would definitely say she plays with history a little bit. It's much more magical realism than strict realism. There are many sections that you would watch, and it looks like you're watching straight realism, and then the stars come out and, you know, we magically go into the mind of Henrietta and we see, you know, the play itself spans 20 years and that's difficult to do in under 2 hours. Yeah, it's very much a biography. It's a historical fiction biography. So she takes, Gunderson takes many moments that we know to be true about the life of Henrietta Leavitt, including her extraordinary discovery, which was... you know, the discovery itself is pretty complicated, but what's really important is that the way that she discovered how that there's information that can be found within the pulsing of the stars themselves, and that made it possible for people to know where we are in the galaxy, that prior to the work of Henrietta Swan Leavitt, astronomy also was a much stronger suit of mine when I was taking astronomy classes many years ago. But that before her work, it wasn't really possible to know for certain that there were galaxies outside of the Milky Way. And she made it possible to measure distances in vast space and sort of define where we are located in the universe and where other galaxies are within the universe.
Otherwise, all the stars were kind of the same twinkling spots.
Yeah, there's actually an argument that these two characters, Josh and Bailey, have later in the show where he is firmly of the opinion that, of course, there's nothing outside of our universe and there doesn't need to be. What?
So she really helps redefine how we understand the universe.
Her work substantially changed our understanding of the universe.
It paved the way to just discover how vast our universe is and that the Milky Way is not all of it.
Hmm. So I suspect that part of the story of Silent Sky is of a woman being in a field that did not have all that many women in it. I mean, can we assume that to be true?
Well, it's interesting. The play really does a great job, I think, of portraying just how hard these women had to work to pursue their passion, what they had to give up in order to be recognized within their field. But the research that I have done has shown that actually there was a lot more acceptance within the fields of science. Like once you were working at the Harvard Observatory, it wasn't, oh, well, you're a woman, so you can
sweep
go
the
file.
Forest.
Right. That, you know, the male scientists respected people with great intelligence. That the resistance that I have been seeing when I have been researching the era itself was more from society in general. Mm. But that's a difficult thing to present in a play that only has five people. We don't have society represented on stage. So what we see is through the character of Peter Shaw, we see that he is walking in kind of representing the notion of the patriarchy, that these women can only do so much and only capable of so much. And we watch his mind expand throughout the play to recognize just how smart these women are.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, we have in the studio Jennifer Sassaman, Bailey Johnston, and Josh Pride to talk about a play that is opening this weekend at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, a play called Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson. It tells the story of three women astronomers, or I think they were, do I remember correctly, they were actually called computers?
That was their job title. They were computers.
Right. So.
And we have to even have that conversation in the play. Bailey has the line,
What is a computer?
And they have to, one who computes.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to remember that words had different meanings before we assigned, you know, before, lost my train of thought.
Before we created machines called computers, there were people called computers. And so Henrietta Swan Leavitt was one such computer. So that's, of course, the same terminology we remember from Hidden Figures, the story of women who worked at NASA in the early days. So these are even earlier days. This is back to the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. Bailey Johnston, so you are performing the role of Henrietta Swan Leavitt. Tell us more about her and what has made her an interesting character for you to portray.
Well, so Henrietta is very, very passionate. And she kind of lets that almost get in the way of some aspects of her personal life. Like she gets the job and she goes to Harvard, and she really just puts her all into her work, which affects her relationship with her sister in the play. Hmm. Her sister's fictional, but she just throws herself into her work because she's just so excited about it, and she kind of forgets to write letters home, which causes problems.
Right.
But she's just so one-track minded almost at some points that it also kind of bleeds into her relationship with Peter.
Hmm. So this is, among other things, a story of someone, in a sense, kind of consumed by their passion for something, and in this case, astronomy.
Yes.
It's predominates everything else in her life, at least to some extent.
Yes.
Which is something we can all relate to.
One of the things that we've been talking about is this is a play that's got two different love stories in it. We have the traditional love story between, you know, the Peter character and the Henrietta mm-hmm. character, but it's also the love story that Henrietta has, the passion that she has for her work. And I feel like there are all different ways that we fall in love in life. And I think that so frequently in dramatic fiction, the love story that we focus on is that, you know, the romantic love, which is, you know, a great story. We like to fall into those stories. But this is equally about falling in love with what gets you up in the morning, what you want to do, what you want to spend your life pouring your attention into.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's find out a little bit about the man who is one half of the one love story that you were just talking about. Josh Pride, the other student in the studio with us, portrays Peter, who is the primary love interest in this play, again, called Silent Sky. So, Josh Pride, tell us more about the character of Peter. What is he like, and what is their relationship like?
Well, Peter is entirely fictional in this story. Lauren Gunderson decided to add the love story, I think, to give a bit of a dynamic to the whole idea of her having to choose astronomy, of that being her passion and the thing that she has to go for. Peter is, he's not passionate about astronomy. He is doing it because his father's kind of forced him into it. You know, he's a product of the time and of the universe that he lives in. And he very much just believes everyone around him of authority. And Henrietta comes in and sort of challenges that. She gives him this, I don't know if it's another way of thinking, but she sort of, she's flirty and coy with him. And he catches on to that. And he's very, very much enticed by her brain. He isn't passionate about astronomy, but he loves that Henrietta is. And I think a lot of Peter is, you see him become passionate about Henrietta, like the same way that she is passionate about astronomy. But I don't know. I like Peter. I like playing him, being able to create a character from the ground up. Nothing to work from except the text.
Right. Well, and it sounds like this is not the conventional situation that we might assume it would be, and where you think a woman's place is in the home and you don't understand why a woman would want to be an astronomer. Sounds like it isn't that at all.
There's like a few moments of that at the beginning, but like Jennifer said, like astronomy was much more equitable back then. I don't think he thinks of himself as better than any of the women that he is working with. He is in a position of authority. I don't think he abuses it, though. If anything, he's a wallflower. He's a gentle boy.
I think, you know, one of the things that I like about Peter is, I've heard people say this, I think he's a lot less woke than he thinks he is.
Yes.
I think Peter thinks that he is quite progressive for the time because he works with women, but he does not see them as equals or peers. I think that he thinks, I am a progressive man, I work with women, and, you know, I recognize that they have some good qualities, and and that it is meeting up with Henrietta, but also the other women who are the computers, who really force him to recognize, no, We are all on an equal playing field. And in fact, this, you know, that these women who really changed the field quite surpass him in their scientific abilities.
Absolutely.
Wow. So ultimately, is Henrietta Swan Leavitt a name that is known in the field of astronomy? And is it a name we should know better? I mean, were her accomplishments appreciated then versus now? I mean, what is her standing?
I feel like I need to talk to an astronomer about that. what I'm seeing is that she was quite recognized at the time. You know, people knew that their work was based on her work. The second major paper that she published, Dr. Pickering was the person who ran the Harvard Observatory, so it was published under his name, but he was very clear on the front page, like, this is the work of Henrietta Leavitt. He was not trying to take her work. Everybody understood that this was her work, and that Hubble, you know, we know the name Hubble. I don't think we know that many names from astronomy.
Right.
So I think that it's very easy to get worked up and say, how dare these names be lost to history? But then I would say, well, how many astronomers do you know?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, this is absolutely a person from history that people should know about. I think that what she did was extraordinary. And I do think that even though she was, to a certain extent, welcome within her field, she had to push very hard to, you know, against what society would have expected of a woman at that time to, you know, give up the life, you know, go and get married and have babies and, like, maybe be a teacher. You know, it's a very different thing to say, no, I'm going to go change the field of science.
Wow. And she did.
She did.
The play is Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson. It is performed this coming weekend, November 22nd through the 24th. And then there is a week off because of Thanksgiving break. But then you are back for more performances December 6th through 8th. If people want tickets, what do they do?
They should go to the website, UWParksideTickets, all one word, .universitytickets.com.
There you go. All right. So Jennifer Sassaman and Bailey Johnston and Josh Pride, all part of this production of Silent Sky. Thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Monday on the morning show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, paying his monthly visit to the program. And by the way, tomorrow on the morning show podcast, you'll hear my conversation with the author of a lovely book about his friendship with Fred Rogers, as in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And we're going to be playing that for the morning show.